I thought a lot about what I should tell you. Those who have heard me speak before know that when I get on to this subject that they've asked me to talk about, it's dangerous because I go for hours. Because there's so many stories. There's thousands of them. But what they've asked me to talk to you a little bit about is something that became known as the second rescue of the Willie and the Martin Handcar companies. People wonder what in the world that was. They wonder, was it a program that was designed by the church to get a bunch of people active doing what they were supposed to be doing anyway? And it wasn't. What the second rescue of the Willie and the Martin Handcar companies was an inspiration that came to a stake president and his counselors that the temple work for the Willie and the Martin Handcart pioneers was not done. Now, if you don't know who the Willie and the Martin Handcart companies were, they were the two last companies in 1856 that got trapped in the snow on the high plains of Wyoming. If you've ever been there to Martin's Cove or the Willie sites, you'll relate with what some people say when they come there, and that is they know now why the pioneers kept moving. Wyoming's kind of a desolate place. And those people found themselves trapped out there on the high plains of Wyoming in a blizzard in October of 1856. Many of them died. Who were those people? If any of you know about your genealogy, and I ask you all to raise your hands, probably most of you, some way or another, are related to one of those two companies. Or at least have pioneer heritage. The second rescue brought many things into our lives, many wonderful and cherished experiences, including it's okay if you don't believe some of the things I tell you because I hardly believe in myself. But one night my wife and I went to dinner at President Hinckley's house. Two nights he came to our house. But those were not the things, although they were special, that I really remember and that I'd like to tell you about. What I'd like to tell you about is a phone call that happened in 1991. I was sitting in my chair next to the bed reading things that came to me as a stake president. During the time that I was the stake president, I received over 6,000 letters from people from all over the world asking me questions about the Martin and the Willie Handcart companies. And I tried to answer them all. That morning I was sitting in there reading about different things, and the phone rang. And I answered it, and I'm not very good with people's names, so I try to repeat their names back to them. And that morning I said, Brother Van Orden, do I know you? And my wife, who was still laying in bed, it was a Saturday morning, she just sat straight up in bed. And she looked at me with those big brown eyes of hers. And I thought, Van Orden, what's the big deal about Van Orden? She got a piece of paper and she wrote on it. She said, he's one of the big guys. I don't know an Elder Van Orden. I know an Elder Monson, an Elder Hinckley, but I don't know an Elder Van Orden. And she could tell that I was really confused. So she wrote underneath that, she wrote, he buys ink by the barrel. I thought, what is she trying to tell me? Then under that she wrote, he's the editor of the church news. And then in great big letters she wrote, be nice. So I thought, well, this guy might write something about us, so I'd better be nice. And anyone who has a journalist in their family like we do knows that you need to be nice or they'll write about you in the newspaper and everybody will think that's the way you are. So I was nice, and he said, we want to write a story about you in the church news. And I said, no stories. We don't want to be in the newspaper. He said, why not? And I said, that's not why we're doing this. We don't want any newspaper articles. We don't want any books written about us, nothing. So he gave me 9 reasons why they should write a story about us. And I said no to every one. Finally, he said, well, let me try number 10. He said, yesterday, President Hinckley spoke about you and your stake in a temple president's seminar. And right afterwards, President Monson called and said, call President Lorimer and get a story. He said, does that affect the way you're thinking at all? And I said, well, if President Monson wants it, go ahead and write it. So they wrote this story. And they published it in October of 1991. And if we had gotten a lot of letters before that, we got thousands of letters after that thing came out in the church news. My counselor came to presidency meeting one morning because we were trying to find all these pioneers. We're trying to find their names and get their temple work done. And he came to presidency meeting one morning and he said, President Lorimer, I got a call from a lady in Rexburg, Idaho. I know where that is. I went to school there. He said, this lady said that she had read the church news article, and she wants us to find the guy that was engaged to her great-grandmother. This guy has 12 degrees. He has 2 doctorates, a bunch of masters, and 1 bachelor's. He's a brilliant guy, and I looked at him like, duh. You know, if it's her great-grandmother's, the guy that she was engaged to, I said, President, that's her great-grandfather. And he said, no, this guy died. I said, well, if the family doesn't know who he was, how are we going to find him? And he said, I don't know, but we're going to find him. She was in the Martin Handcar Company. Her name was Sarah Ann Franks. And they wanted us to find this guy that she was engaged to. That died. So my counselors decided that they were going to find this guy. They took it on as a personal challenge to find this guy. They went to the ship's log. They figured if they were engaged, and I can see some of you who may not be engaged, but you sit together. They figured that if they were engaged, they probably got on the ship together. Makes sense. Well, they found Sarah Ann Franks on the ship's log, and she didn't get on the ship with a single bachelor. She got on the ship with a family that had 5 little kids with a different last name. We learned that she was acting kind of as a nanny to help pay her way with these 5 little kids. So that didn't work. So then my counselor said, well, let's see if there's any eligible bachelors in the Martin Handcart Company between the ages of 18 and 26. You think there were any? There's a whole slew of them. It's 20-some-odd guys. Then they said, well, let's see if any of those guys are from her hometown. So they started reading and researching, and 9 of them were. So then they said, well, let's see if any of those 9 guys died in Martin's Cove. 3 of them did. This was taking a lot of time. They were doing this for weeks, my counselors. We were busy. We were trying to build monuments. We were trying to get temple work done. We were going up and down the road to Ogden. All of our people were extremely busy. And here sat my 2 counselors fooling around, trying to find this guy. Finally, out of absolute frustration with both of them, I said to them, I said, would you guys knock it off? I said, just pick one. And they said, no way, we're not doing that. We're going to find him. I said, for crying out loud, you guys, the family doesn't know who it was. Nobody knows. If you won't pick one, just send them the 3 names and let them pick one. I said, no, we're going to find this guy. I said, you will never find him. It's impossible. I said, no, we're going to find him. You should never say never. About 4 weeks later, I was sitting in the same chair reading letters, and one had come from all places Johannesburg, South Africa. Opened the letter. There's a letter in there, handwritten. The guy says, "President Lorimer, I read about you and your stake in the church news and what you're doing with the Willie and the Martin Hancock companies, and I thought my great-grandfather's journal might help you. Please find it enclosed." Well, we've gotten journals from all over everywhere. They're really hard to read. Any of you that have done genealogy know that those old manuscripts, they're about the 100th photocopy of a copy. The writing is real scrolly, and they're just hard to read. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and I didn't really want to read it. But it was only 4 pages long. So I thought, I can read 4 pages. I got to page 3. On page 3 of this man's journal is a one-liner. It's a wonderful one-liner. It says, quote, "Sarah Ann Franks," that's the woman, "is betrothed to George Padley," close quote. I was so excited, I called my counselors. It was 10:30 at night. I said, for crying out loud, what were the names of those 3 guys that you guys found? And they couldn't remember. I said, meet me at the stake center right now. They said, we're in bed. I said, doesn't matter. We found this guy. One counselor drove to the stake center with me, and we called the other one because he lives 22 miles away. And sure enough, we found him. We knew who she was engaged to. His name was George Padley. George Padley got on the ship. He's the 4th to the last guy that got on the ship. He's probably a normal young man fiddling around with something, and he was late getting on the ship. That's why he wasn't with Sarah. Then we could put the whole story together. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. President Faust says that it's probably one of the greatest love stories of our time. What happened was Sarah Ann Franks and George Padley were your age. We're not talking about people my age. They were in their early 20s. They had met in England because some missionaries came over and taught them the gospel. And when they went to church, they saw each other, they fell in love, and they wanted to be married. The missionaries had taught them about being sealed. Sarah Ann Franks and George Padley could have got married in England before they got on the ship. But it was their choice. And their choice was that they would wait until they could go to the endowment house and be sealed for time and all eternity. They came all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. They came most of the way across the American continent, waiting for the time that they could be sealed together. On the North Platte River, on the last crossing of the Platte, George Padley and the Martin Hancock Company met the blizzards of October of 1856. George Padley spent most of the day in the river. The North Platte River is a large river. Large chunks of ice, we read in the journals, were floating down, hitting people. Lots of people drown. George Padley was one of those young men, like you young men, who had a testimony, who desired to serve others. He stood in that freezing water for hours, helping people across the Platte River. It's not the famous one that we hear about where the young men carried them across the Sweetwater, but it had the same effect. George Padley got chilled. suffered hypothermia, never recovered, made it all the way to Martin's Cove, which is another 50, 60 miles. And there, George Padley laid down this mortal life. Sarah Ann Franks loved George Padley. She loved him a lot. You read in the journals about what happened, about how they took the dead over the other side of the cove, and they just dug little trenches in the snow with their plates and put the bodies in the trenches and covered them up as best they could. These people had been existing on 9 ounces of flour for 2 weeks. 9 ounces of flour a day. They didn't have nice Reebok shoes or good stuff to eat or how to stay warm. They did the best they could with the dead. But the journals are very graphic of what happened. Martin's Cove was full of wolves. And the wolves would come in and ravage the bodies. And they talk about the snarling and the snapping of the wolves as they fought over the body parts of the deceased members of the Martin Handcart Company. Sarah Ann Franks did not want her George to be eaten by the wolves. She took off one of probably the only things she had to stay warm. It was a shawl. And she had the brethren wrap George in the shawl and hang him up in a tree. One of the trees in Martin's Cove is where George Padley's body was put. That was the last thing Sarah Ann Frank saw as she left Martin's Cove. When she got to Salt Lake and learned that the next spring, brethren were going back to pick up the supplies that were held at the fort, she asked that they please take George's body down from the tree and give him a proper burial. Well, when they got there, all that was left was the shawl. George's body had decayed and Mother Nature had taken its course, and the wolves and the animals had carried George up into the rocks. There was no George anymore, just the shawl. They took the shawl back to Sarah Ann Franks and gave it to her. And her family today still has that shawl. They've brought it back to Martin's Cove. Sarah Ann Franks had some frozen toes and fingers. She was taken into the home of Thomas Mackey, where she was nursed back to health. Eventually, Sarah Ann Franks married Thomas Mackey. She became the third plural wife of Brother Mackey. Raised a wonderful posterity. We've met thousands of their descendants, or hundreds of their descendants. They're tremendous people. They've stood in Martin's Cove with tears in their eyes as they realize the sacrifice that their great-grandmother made. That was the end of the story for 138 years. We took President Faust in Martin's Cove, and I had him tell the story that I just told you. My counselor told him the story. President Faust, when he heard the story, got great big tears in his eyes. And they just wouldn't stop. They ran down his face. And he asked me, he said, "President Lorimer, did you seal Sarah Ann Franks to George Padley?" I said, "No, President, we didn't. We can't. She sealed to Thomas Mackey. She has children with Thomas Mackey, and she sealed to him." President Faust became very emotional and had a very difficult time speaking. Finally, he mumbled out, he said, "President, you go back to the Ogden Temple and you seal Sarah and Frank's to George Padley. You give her a choice." You couldn't do that back then without approval of the First Presidency. A woman could only be sealed to one man. It's been changed since, but at that time it couldn't happen. We went back. What a glorious day that was. I don't know how that'll all sort out, because she's sealed to both, and they're both certainly worthy. I know a few things, though. I know a little bit about Sarah Ann Franks. And I know that she loved George. And she wanted nothing more than to be his eternal companion. I know a little about George. I know that George loved Sarah. And the only reason he was not her eternal companion was because he gave his life that others might live. I know a lot about Thomas Mackey. Thomas Mackey must have been a wonderful, wonderful man. I know that because I've met his posterity. They're tremendous people. I know that he understands about George and Sarah. I know that Sarah probably wants her own husband. She probably doesn't want to share him with two other women. I also know that George Padley loves every one of the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of Sarah Ann Franks. And I know they love him. That was the end of the story again for a while. Last year, I got another letter. Opened it up. I said, "President Lorimer, I heard you tell the story about Sarah Ann Franks. I thought you might like this." And I have it here with me today. This is a copy of Sarah Ann Franks' patriarchal blessing. And there's another one-liner. We're all known for something. I think Sarah's known as a one-line gal. This one is tremendous. Sarah Ann Franks did not get her patriarchal blessing until she was 72 years old. She had raised a family. She had been sealed in the temple. There were no temple ordinances that Sarah didn't have. This is what the patriarch told Sarah in her 72nd year. Quote, "Sarah, you will be allowed the privilege of returning to the house of the Lord and receiving the ordinance that awaits you." Close quote. When Sarah got that blessing, there weren't any other ordinances. She was sealed to a husband, she was sealed to her kids, and she had her endowments. It wasn't anything more. But the patriarch told her she'd go back to the house of the Lord and receive the ordinance, just one, that awaited her. I can't tell you how I felt the first time I read that. How in the world did that patriarch know that 138 years later, a member of the First Presidency would grant her the privilege of being sealed to George. If anyone thinks that we live in a world of coincidence, a world that is not directed by prophets, seers, and revelators through the power of revelation and inspiration, through worthy priesthood leaders in our stakes, our patriarchs, and our bishops, they're really mistaken. The Lord knows who you are. The Lord knew who Sarah was. The Lord gave Sarah a promise that she probably did not even understand. She had to leave this world to comprehend it. And she had to wait an awful long time. But the Lord knew Sarah's heart. And he also knew George. One day we'll see them. And that'll be an interesting reunion. I want each one of you young people to know of your worth. The Lord loves you. The Lord is very mindful of the decisions that you are making. He will put big defensive ends in your path. They are not obstacles. They are opportunities through which you can learn. He will allow you to be banged around a little and will help you make the right decisions. If you're worthy, I promise you that. I know that it's true. I'm grateful for you being here today and allowing me the opportunity of sharing one small story with you of some people that have become my friends. I'm grateful for the gospel of Jesus Christ. I know that it's true. I'm grateful for the opportunities that it has served, that it afforded me to serve others. For through that service, I've become a little more polished. There's a lot of polishing left to do. I bear you my testimony that we're led by a prophet, seer, and revelator. I know that as much as I know anything. I'm grateful for him and for his guidance and direction in our lives. I bear you this testimony, and I do so in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.